Hey everyone, turn on, tune in, keep up. Welcome back to another week's episode of Rising Giants with your hosts Max Thornton and Dominic Kalusic, releasing a podcast every Wednesday. Today on the show, we're diving even further into the Thailand startup ecosystem, and we've got Surasit Sachdev, one of the OG tech founders in the country, having founded Hungry Hub in 2014. It's a unique dining reservation app in Thailand. They offer exclusive fixed price concepts at normal a la carte restaurants. Hungry Hub has served over 1.3 million diners and currently work with over 600 restaurant partners in Bangkok, Pattaya, and Phuket. We really hope you enjoy tuning into this episode, and if you can get a chance, please give us a review on your favorite podcast app, whether that be Spotify, Google, Apple. Thanks again.
Surasit, welcome to Rising Giants. We're very excited to be diving into your business today, Hungry Hub from Thailand, which is the number one restaurant reservation app in the country that offers exclusive fixed price concepts at a la carte restaurants, among other things. You're the co-founder and CEO, and we are really excited to start off the conversation with learning a bit about your background and how you got started into your path towards entrepreneurship.
Hi, Dom. Thank you for having me here today. Yeah, so definitely excited to be part of this podcast.
Thank you very much. And I think a great place to start would be telling us a little bit about your early journey in your career, kind of where you started and maybe some of the skills and learnings that you took away before founding the company.
Sure. So yeah, I mean, started Hungry Hub in 2014. So let me go back to maybe after I graduated from university. I actually graduated from uni from Australia, even though I'm born and raised in Thailand. But I graduated since I was 19 from Wollongong University. And straight off, I went to work in the corporate world. I went into Standard Chartered Bank in Bangkok. I was working I actually graduated in business information systems, so a mix of commerce and a mix of like IT, you can say, kind of in between, not really going to hardcore coding, knowing a little bit of background into programming, but also understanding the whole economics, accounting, management, and all that kind of thing. So I went into a operations support role in the bank for a year, did that for a year in Thailand, then got an opportunity to move to Singapore for 2 years within the same bank, but doing different roles. So I was doing regional group role, doing like dashboards, metrics, KPI reportings, and all these kind of things for the group on different projects. And then I became a project manager, rolling out a system to help speed up the turnaround time of credit card applications and all these different applications from the branch to the operations, speed up that whole process. So I was doing that for 19 countries. I was in charge of maybe 3 or 4 countries. So I was traveling a bit, working a lot with the IT team, the business team, trying to deliver that. So it was semi, almost like a mini startup within the bank. Although we didn't have to do fundraising and worry about the finance, but we were trying to deliver on time and all that. So that was my kind of first experience of doing something to do with system implementation, and being a project manager is kind of a little bit like a CEO as well. Then after that, I realized that I got other opportunities within the bank or even externally, but I was like, it wasn't feeling fulfilling. I felt like the challenge, there was a lot of internal politics that you have to play the game to grow. And that for me was not fun. So I was like, okay, let's get out of the corporate world. I don't think it's just specifically the bank that I was in. I think it's pretty much every large corporate. When you're in the middle management, it's how you play your game to get promoted and be close to this person and have coffee with that person. And I felt like that wasn't really what I wanted. So then I was at the verge of, at that point of time, 2010, 2011, there was no real talk of startups. So I decided that, okay, I want to come back and build some technology, some own system that can help me do businesses that I don't have to be there all the time, or it can even work on weekends while I was resting, or the business could still generate money. So I was thinking about all these online travel because my family is in the hotel business. So we have multiple hotels in Bangkok and Phuket. So I was thinking about, okay, maybe an online travel agent similar to the Agodas of the world. 2011 was still very early days for them. So then I did some research. And then at that point of time, I saw that Agoda was spending, not Agoda, Priceline, the parent company of AgodaBooking.com at that point of time was Priceline Group, was spending $1 billion a year just on Google Ads. So I'm like, how am I going to compete with those guys where I'm just a 21-year-old guy in Thailand with no funds to support? So I was like, okay, this industry is too global. It shouldn't be my first business I jump into. So then I thought about the restaurant industry and came across the Open Table model, which is an online reservation for restaurants. So then I was like, okay, started working, talking to some tech people, trying to find co-founders. But then I realized that I was living abroad, like Australia 3 years, Singapore 2 years. After my high school graduation, I didn't know people in the business industry. So to jump into a business alone, after living abroad for 5 out of 6 years, I was like, it's a bit too risky. I need a co-founder. I need someone in the tech that can help. And it's a tech business. I don't want to outsource all the tech out. At that time, there was no ecosystem, no startup ecosystem, no place to mingle, no networking events. So I realized that, okay, maybe it's not the right time. Why don't I go and do my MBA in Thailand to kind of build that network? So I went to Sassin, which is one of the leading MBA program in Thailand. It has a very international program. So it has collaborations with Kellogg, Wharton, which I did my exchange at Wharton in the US. So during my first day at Sassin, during the orientation, I was pitching Hungry Hub idea to all my classmates and like basically got like 10 people into the room, pitch for like half an hour. No one was interested. Everyone was there to like party and have a good time and get a break from their life, work life. So I was a bit like a fool then. But luckily, actually, on the third or fourth day during like in Sassin, there's a bonding trip between the year two MBA students and the year one. So we actually got a chance to catch up. And the year two, there was one weird student like me, which was actually taking part in the business plan competition that Sassin kind of supported. So he basically already completed the first year business plan competition and he was going to second year and he was also wanting to do another one. So he recruited me to join him on his startup journey hunt. So we didn't have an idea. He was just recruiting team to build a company without an idea. So I said, okay, sure. I came here to find to basically find co-founders to start my own company, but I can join another company too. I just want to learn the startup process. Luckily, Sassin supports you to like go to the US, go to India, go to different parts of the world to compete if you make it. So it was like, why not? So I did that. We went to 5 competitions. We won 2. We came top 3 in 2. Yeah, amongst like Stanford, amongst like Harvard students and all that. So it was great experience. Got to understand, I think, the VC perspective. Got to like register a company. Got to do all the groundworks of setting up a company. So I stayed with him for a year. And then in my second year, I realized that we have different visions of how we want to take this company forward. And he was graduating, so he could take it full time. I wasn't able to. So I left that company. And then tried to pitch the Hungry Hub story again with more experience. And I was able to gather 4 out of 5 of my classmates this time. And plus three others, plus me is 4. And then we have my brother-in-law, which joined me. He was the one pushing me because he heard that I had and he saw the competitions that I took part. So yeah, 5 of us set up the company. And right after we graduated, we were starting to do the groundworks before we graduated, got the logo, got the company set up. So in Jan 2014, we officially set up the company, but we really started off business side was around mid of 2014. So yeah, it's almost 9.5 years now.
Wow. That is an incredible journey it actually resonates quite a bit for myself because I did work at Bank of America for about 3 years and had the same feeling that you had. in terms of fulfillment and wanting to do something, whether it was on your own or just something a little bit more. And so I understand, because I'm pretty sure Standard Charter has probably what, over 80,000 employees or something like that too. So you just feel like you're a cog in the machine. Yeah. And even that deciding to go to business school and coming to school and being like, well, yeah, I'm here to actually start up a company, and everybody else is like, wait, I'm actually here to do a 2-year vacation. it's kind of funny to that you actually speak that from your experience and it being, you know, relatively true. But you know, it always comes out in the wash. So finishing school, finding co-founders to be able to start the business. I think a great place to start with Hungry Hub too is just, how did you identify the gap in that market that led to the creation of the company?
So, I mean, the Hungry Hub has two versions. So the version we started off, version one, was purely a copy of what existed in the US and why not in Thailand. So it was a very naive young boy who was like, I want to start a company, right? And there's all the wrong things that you have to do as starting a company without doing market research. So what I did, the research, was I went to the restaurants and I was like, if I built the reservation system called Hungry Hub, would you use it, right? And obviously the business model, the way we designed it, was the open table model is they charge a monthly fee, like a small monthly fee, and then a cover charge, right? And the small monthly fee was almost like a no-brainer. It was peanuts, right? Like $15 a month, like almost like a SaaS model for using the system. And then they actually would pay, like the main amount would come from if we source them customer. But we didn't go and ask the consumer whether there was a real need for a reservation system, because in Thailand, you could pretty much just pick up a phone or search on Google, get the number, pick up the phone, call, and 99.99% get accepted for a table. And the reason why Open Table existed was because there was not a lot of open tables available. So Open Table was solving a problem of like finding it hard to book a restaurant on a Friday evening or a Saturday evening. But in Thailand, there was oversupply of restaurants, and still there is today, that there's no real need for reservation. There's only like a handful of restaurants. It's not enough restaurants that need to book. Hence, the culture is not there. So I guess we basically just did the wrong market research for the first model. But given being in the industry for almost 3 years before we pivoted, we realized that every restaurant joined us because they wanted more customers, not because of the efficiency, not because of the technology. They just needed more customers, and all the other players out there were not really sourcing them customers at a sustainable margin. So there were a lot of players out there before us that was focusing on sourcing customers, whether it's be Groupons of the world or the other names. But all of them were focusing on discounts. And the model has always been like either booking during off-peak hours and you get more discounts, or booking anytime and you get a lot of discounts, or even credit card discounts. At the end of the day, the restaurants realized that these were not sustainable models. And if you don't sustain your supply source, you can't even deliver to your consumer, right? So what the restaurants were doing, join for 3 months, sign the smallest contract, and then after 3 months, they leave. So it became a merchant acquisition business, which was not long-term, right? Then we saw that as a pain. And then on the consumer side, I used to take my team out for dinners and lunch every month when we were doing the reservation system for 2 years. And every month I go out to a restaurant. I didn't like buffets. I didn't want to go to a buffet restaurant. I like to go for a nice normal meal at a restaurant where you sit down, you get to converse. Because the whole point of going out as a team is to have a nice conversation and get to bond, right? But if you go to a buffet, everyone's mingling with the food more than each other. So as a consumer, I was like, I need a solution for myself. So I need to know how much the bill is going to come to. Every time I go out, I would enjoy the meal, look at the bill at the end of the meal and realize, shit, that's not what I signed up for. I would expect to pay, let's say, $15 a head, because that's how much I spend when I go and dine there on my own or with my wife. But with a team, it's like $50 a person or like $40 a person. And as an entrepreneur, obviously, it's my own money, right? So it's even worse, right? Like for companies, they've been given a budget and then the boss has to like basically takes out the extra.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, that's the challenge. And I was like, let me just try to solve my own problem. And that's where we are today.
Well, yeah, that's great. I think one of the key pieces there is having the humility of knowing, like, you know, as a young entrepreneur, you're going in and just wanting to start something and then quickly realizing that there's no problem solution fit for the current product that you're offering, and then being able to pivot that business to something that is a problem solution fit. And so, you know, one of those things is, I mean, from the reservations into the dining offers, I would say the next part of that, it would be great to give the audience a bit of an overview of what the dining offers encapsulates. That would be great to dive into now.
Sure. So yeah, Hungry Hub as a business model today is basically, we started off in 2017, the second model, as we converted a la carte restaurants into an all-you-can-eat dining experience. So you get 2 hours to dine at an a la carte restaurant that currently don't offer buffet. But through Hungry Hub, if you book a table, you get like an X price per person net. It's including a service charge and all the taxes. You get to dine as an all-you-can-eat. That was the first product, which we were very unique in the market, right? So, but obviously it was very hard to convert a lot of the restaurants to all-you-can-eat, especially the fine dinings and all. So then we saw the second opportunity to do it, which was, we call it party pack. So party pack simply means back in the day, it's very common that restaurants have set menus. But set menus, I feel, is designed for the Western market, which is mostly individual courses set menus. So it's like a 3-course, 4-course, 5-course, where you get a main, appetizer, dessert, or like a salad, a soup, or something like that, right? But in the Asian culture, it's all about sharing. Everything comes in the middle, from like your soup, from the salad, from the steak, all the way to the dessert, right? Nothing is like given individually. So, and the Asian culture is about trying a lot of things, because when they share food, they get more variety, and then they're used to that, right? Whereas the Western way, it's like everything is individualized, and each person kind of eats their own dishes and pay their own meal. Yeah.
Family style, so, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so I guess when we saw that problem, we said that, okay, why don't we do Party Pack, which was the second model. And I'm not, like I mentioned from the beginning, I'm not a buffet lover, but I did the buffet just to control the budget. But there was another opportunity to control the budget, which was a sharing set. And our sharing sets are very flexible. We almost take the entire menu and we group into high cost, medium cost, low cost. But then we obviously has a lot of caveat for like what to include, what to not include. So that's basically a unique value proposition today, is we help the restaurant come up with the menu, the pricing of what to do that has a higher chance of conversion. Obviously, the restaurant has a final say, but 90% of the time they listen to us today. But in the early days, obviously, we let them design it, and we obviously went through a lot of low conversion deals. Today is high conversion and high retention deals, because we know the food costs, we know the margins. We might not get it right 100%, but I think we are at 70 to 80% accuracy with our deals now when we go to market. So today we have 3 different business models that are operating, where it's dine-in is basically all you can eat. And party pack. We also, for all you can eat, we also work with existing buffet restaurants now, where if you book through us, you get a special benefit. It's like added menu at maybe different price or the same price, added time, added drinks, something. All Hungry Hub deal is exclusive, full stop. Mm. We don't sell the same deal as a walk-in customer. So the differentiation between Hungry Hub and a direct channel is we have exclusive deal, and all our deals are fixed price, and it's all net. It's including a service charge, VAT, and most of the time, 90%+ of the time, it includes a drink or two or free flow or something. So as a consumer, you pretty much know how much your meal will cost if you don't go extra. So you can be full with the meal that we provide with a drink or water at a fixed price. Yeah, so today that's kind of the way we structure the business. And we third one, sorry, I forgot, is experience, which is staycation where we bundle the room and the food and the spa and all that kind of thing together.
Okay. Yeah, thank you for going through each of the products that you offer to customers. You mentioned about low conversion early on, and I'm really curious to learn about how you were, when you first approached restaurants with this idea, what was their initial reaction? Was it something that they were receptive to, or what was their feedback that they gave?
Yep. So the first time I talked about all you can eat to a non all you can eat restaurant, they almost sent me out the door.
Right. I was about to say that has to be a bit of a crazy concept, yes. Right?
So, I mean, a lot of people, when they heard it, they're like, are you crazy? You're trying to do this? When I opened my restaurant, I already chose that I'm not going to be an all you can eat. And you're telling me I'm going to be an all you can eat now. So I have to explain them my story, why I started it, and then they could relate it, and then they would consider it. But before we started the second model of Hungry Hub, we had about 250 partners, existing partners, which we haven't taken down. We were trying to convince these 250 partners that at least one of you come and try. So luckily, we actually got one to try. After pitching it to maybe 50 of them, one agreed to try because it was their 50th anniversary coming up and they didn't know what to do with it yet. So they were like, okay, maybe on this 50th anniversary, that one day, we're going to do 3 rounds of all you can eat and we'll let the booking come through you. So we did that. That restaurant, The whole month, we would do like maybe 100 covers booking, like a booking alone. But on that one day, we did one branch, 360 covers in 12 hours, we sold out. So they did 220 covers, lunch, afternoon, and dinner. 3 rounds on their 50th anniversary, and they sold exclusively through us. Within 12 hours, we sold out. And they were shocked. They've never had that kind of success. And it was a model that we approached. But then they were like, it's hard for us to put a lot of people, the kitchen and all that, for like long term and all that. My business model that I approached them long term was not to do 100% of their seat into all you can eat. We were supposed to take only their leftover seat, which was 20-30%, and convert it into all you can eat. So you can sell it all day round and sell it all month round, not just for a particular day where you have to prepare in advance and all that. So they had to go and fix their operations internally, design the menu. And then a few months later, they came back. And they are still one of our top partners till today. But that was the first partner. Then the rest, obviously, we use the numbers to convince. And yeah, from 50 to get first, 10 to get second, 5 to get third. Now every 2 or 3 restaurants, we close one.
Wow. At that point, it's just a natural effect that you have one case study, you present that to the next potential partners. And as your list grows larger, then it builds that confidence in future partners that are interested. What's interesting that you mentioned is about planning to be able to integrate this part of a la carte into an existing partner. And usually, and at the beginning, you said that it was more on them to take care of the operations. Is it right now that Hungry Hub is helping with that operation side of the business too? Or is it still primarily with the partner to figure out how they want to structure that organization?
So to convert an a la carte into an all you can eat, when we say all you can eat is we don't ask for like a buffet line. What we ask is basically a separate menu that we help them come up with, which that in that menu you can order as much as you want as long as you don't waste. So we have a one-page term and condition where you can't waste, you can't share the food with other tables, all these kind of things where it's pretty standard and it's straightforward. So for a restaurant, it's pretty much like an a la carte operation. It's just that when you do the billing, instead of billing per dish, it's a bill per person. So and the kitchen just basically cooks more food for that table, but they are paying a price per person rather than a price per dish. So operationally, there's almost no change. It's just they need to book through Hungry Hub to get that deal. And when they arrive, they just have to show their booking number, get seated, served a separate menu. But the menu is from the normal a la carte, but we cut down certain items or we limit certain items to one per person. So operationally, we don't go in and get involved at all. It's pretty much the same a la carte operations. Nobody knows the difference that there is a Hungry Hub customer there. It's just that table is ordering a lot, which is you can order a lot and pay a la carte price too. So from a restaurant and from other consumer and the full experience of the dining, it's almost the same.
Okay, great. And I think before we hop into later on, just curious about how many active restaurants that you currently have and kind of like the market sizing of potential for Hungry Hub overall.
Right. So right now we have about 1,400 restaurant partners. And when I count by outlets, because for us, every outlet gives us more seats to sell, even though it's the same brand, because it's located separately, it's like has a different customer base. So average each restaurant, we get like maybe 20, 30 seats. So we, per day, we probably have 40,000. And one day you can sell multiple rounds. It can even go up to 100,000. But let's say you do one round a day, we can sell up to like 30,000, 40,000 seats. So a month, we actually have like almost 1 million seats to fill, but we're still like a long way to go. Yeah. And market size wise, there is probably around 20,000 restaurants that fits within whatever we do. In Thailand, according to the food delivery guys and the restaurant directories and all this, there's like 600,000 restaurants. But most of them are like street food vendors or like, you know, the trolleys that sell food on. So those wouldn't fit Hungry Hub. Hungry Hub only works for seat, like basically a full service restaurant, which I would say accounts for maybe about 20,000 to 30,000 throughout Thailand. In Bangkok, probably around 10 to 12,000. So if you say that we are at 1,400, we're not even 5% market share in terms of supply side acquisition.
Okay. And what has the competition been like? I think we were discussing this earlier about like, you know, taking on bigger guys with, and you know, not maybe having as much funding. Yeah. What's it been like kind of going up against kind of whoever's come through and tried to compete with you?
I think there were guys that started off before us. There were guys that came in from overseas. I think the key thing is understanding the market and understanding the consumer and the merchants. Like, so reservation, for example, there was a player that came in from Singapore with reservation system. They understood their market in Singapore. The founders were Singaporeans. The pain in Singapore is not the same pain in Thailand, right? So building a reservation system was what we did ourselves. Till today, they're still doing that. But we realized that in 3 years, the market is too small for it. But because they were operating in a multi-country, they had to kind of like put their coverage on the ground. But the volume is not going to reach anything close to where we are because we're actually helping the restaurants. Secondly, the business model of like discounts, we knew from our conversation within 3 years of selling the reservation system to restaurant that they were unhappy with. So I think understanding and making a lot of the platforms were focused on consumer first because they realized the Groupon model is if the consumers are happy, they're going to somehow squeeze the restaurant to do it because everyone wants the consumers. But then at the end of the day, if there's no margins left, there's going to be no restaurants. And then at the end, there's no consumer, right? So for me, it's like our supply has to be strong first. Fundamentally, every business, some business goes with consumer first and squeeze the supply later on. But I think for that, it might work if you can improve the efficiency or if you can use technology to solve the supply problem. But the restaurant industry is almost very difficult to do that. So it's almost, you. For example, like let's say you sell low airline tickets first, but then you're going to get economies of scale by increasing your airline and optimizing your costs later on. So you can cover that low ticket price. But with the restaurant industry, you are not operating the supply on your end, right? You are banking on a third party. So I think understanding that from day one because we were 3 years in the industry before we kind of pivoted another model, really helped us, is what I said, what I would say. We've been slower, but I think our rise has been persistent. When we started off, they had like 1,000 restaurants and we had like zero. Today we have 1,000 plus and they have 300, each of them. So with each of them had 10 times more funding than us.
Okay, yeah, that's a good segue into like into funding. So I think to date you've raised 2 million. What's it been like doing that and, you know, raising capital? I mean, obviously we're from, predominantly in Phnom Penh and it's pretty hard to raise capital here for startups, but I think Thailand's a little bit easier, but only once you get to the point of a certain size, right? And then you can work with these corporates or CVCs, et cetera, and obviously some regional VCs. So what was that whole journey like for you doing fundraising? What are some of the maybe tips that you have for people listening on how to go about that better?
Yeah, I mean, I think investors in Asia is a little bit more cautious in general than the West. I think there's not much like experts. So I would call the ecosystem like startup 1.0. Maybe we are moving towards 2.0. But the reason why I call it startup 1.0 is because a lot of the founders have no back experience of actually founding the business before or like a startup before. It's almost like almost all the founders are like first-time founders. Right. And it's very different when you fundraise as a first time founder versus a second time or third time founder. Because if you've had experience of either running your own startup or being in a co-founder of another startup or exiting a startup, then you can raise almost at idea stage. Like not even having customer or revenue, you can raise. And I think you guys just had a what do you call Harprem on your podcast recently, which for him, second time, third time raising is much easier.
He makes it sound so easy.
Yeah. So actually for me, as a first time founder, when we were doing the reservation system, I pitched a lot. And because the business was not right, there's no chance of you getting funding. So I think first you need to get the fundamentals right and get the kind of reach the product market fit to a certain level. Then get funding. But in the Western world, you get funding at idea stage with very little validation. So I think that's because there's so less supply of funding, they almost can pick and choose the one that basically people are giving like Series A level startup seed funding in terms of validation. And that's how I see it today. So unless you have access or like connections to get angels yourself to go directly to VC for a seed round, is not very easy. They all expect like numbers, and that whole process of funding takes about 3 to 4 months. And they're looking at your growth during that 3 to 4 months with no money in sight. So you need to make your business model strong. So luckily for us, in about 2019, we were already profitable. We were doing about $300,000 in annual GMV. So it's not a small number at that point. And that was when we started getting traction started getting attention, and then we got our first round of funding. No, actually we were doing 3 million annual GMV. Yeah, that was our first round of funding, $3 million of annual GMV. We were doing $300,000 a month roughly. And yeah, that's when we raised our first round, about $500,000 from 500 Tuk Tuk, and then at that time Expara, which was an institutional VC, and then now they moved it to Nvest. But then further than that, during COVID, we pivoted. I think with the key is once you've been validated and you are able to prove that you are able to do things right, then I think the second and third and fourth round, it becomes a little bit easier. The market has been really bad in the last year and a half. So I think this has been the kind of like, because of whole economy coming out of COVID, inflation, all these other things, cost of capital becoming more expensive. And so VCs, when everyone, all the big guys stop investing, it becomes like there is a lot of time to choose. There's no rush in the investment process. There's no like rat race going on. So I think this is like clearly to define like who's making it, who has enough gunpowder to survive and still grow will come out stronger, I would say.
Right. What's the thing that Buffett says? I think when the sea goes out, you see who's been swimming naked, right?
Yeah, correct.
Maybe just touching on that there, of course, your business, I'm sure, was heavily impacted by COVID, it being like, you know, a business that requires, you know, putting together a lot of people in a space. So maybe you can just touch on like how you were able to survive COVID overall.
So yeah, I mean, lucky for me, I was actually in China for Alibaba e-founders program, November of 2019, November, December. So that was when COVID was getting started. So I think in Jan and Feb, there was like the Alibaba team was like kind of sharing about what's happening in China, like the restaurant industry, because Alibaba has a food delivery business as well. And they were sharing like how people delivering food and stuff like that. Restaurants were shut. So I was like, there's no way Thailand's not going to face this. So I better launch a food delivery business 2 weeks before shutdown. I anticipated there was going to be a lockdown coming up. 2 weeks before the shutdown, we started the food delivery discussion with restaurants. We started building, we tweaked our system. And 3 days after lockdown, we launched it. So we basically turned a dine-in business, of which I said I will never go into food delivery space. I decided that there was an opportunity for the premium dining category. That what I realized that most of these guys that we were working with was not on any food delivery platform. So I saw that gap. And secondly, I saw that their price, for example, they were selling pasta at like $10 a dish, whereas outside like street food pasta shop was selling it for $3 or $5. So how are my restaurants going to survive this COVID if they still sell it the same way? But if they lower the price, then they're going to come out looking at a cheaper brand. So we said, why don't we sell it as a set, like a bundle, like a party pack? So we basically bundle the groups together and let the customer choose and get it at a fixed meal price. So it's almost like a party at your house from premium type of restaurant where you can still get lobster, get different products delivered from premium restaurants. So we actually onboarded. And the good thing was, at that point of time, Grab, Foodpanda, Line Man, all the other food delivery players were busy onboarding everyone who wanted to rush to get them. So we were like free and onboarding slowly the big guys, the ones that really had high margins and stuff. So luckily, we were able to build traction because we already had their user base, because we were doing the business for them for a while. So we had their like customers. So we onboarded them. We were able to help these restaurants recover maybe 30, 50% of their revenue during lockdown months. And for us, we were also able to cover 30 to 50% of our revenue and cover most of our costs, because we obviously leaned down a lot and try to save costs. So we were losing money, but we were losing much less than not doing anything. So yeah, that was our first thing that we did during COVID. Then we saw the hotel segment was struggling. Obviously, no tourists were coming in. And we were working with a lot of hotel restaurants, and they were struggling to compete with non-hotel restaurants because their price were not friendly to locals. They didn't want to lower their positioning, especially the big brands. So we said, why don't you bundle the room and the F&B together? Because people had no reason to come and stay in your hotel. But if you bundled it and make the room look like free, if you spend very high on F&B, then it may be interesting for the consumer to look at it as a win-win experience. So we launched Staycation in end of 2020. And that business was very big for us. Like last year was like 2022 was 30% of our total sales, 25%. So during COVID months, it was like some months, like even 30, 40%. But then as tourists came back, obviously that started to go back down. And the delivery, we just stopped beginning of this year fully because dine-in is our core. We didn't want to confuse the customer. We just have that technology ready for whenever there is any need. But our main business is still dine-in because that's the problem that we're solving. Staycation, it was a short-term to help the restaurants survive and the hotels survive during COVID. Yeah.
Great. And yeah, something you just mentioned earlier as well is about like the, you know, the how that relates to COVID and like the rebound that we've seen to some extent in some of the countries in the region and Thailand recovering on the tourism numbers. But you also mentioned about how the funding environment has changed. What I guess the overall question I'm trying to get to is like, how would you rate the overall like Thai economy right now? Like what does it look like for 2024 versus 2023, for example?
So economy in the eyes of me looking at 1,400 restaurants is quite shit right now. 2023, there was election, which was like after almost 10 years that the military was ruling the country. But that election was also somehow, as you guys know, the winning party didn't get it. And there was like 2 months of debate after winning the election. Then the party that came second basically ended up forming the government. But for us as Hungry Hub, I got a missed out in sharing. In 2019 to 2020, we grew 50%. 2021, we grew another 50%. So 2022, we grew 85%. So we actually came out of COVID in 2022, 4x our sales in 2019. Most businesses in the F&B industry were only recovering their 2019 number in 2022. So for us, 2023 was a tough year because we were reversing the delivery, the staycation business that we were benefiting out of COVID was actually coming back, was reversed while we were still growing our core business, but the COVID benefits was getting like going down towards zero, right? And 2024, we think will go down towards zero because of the delivery and the staycation is not our strength and it's not something we want to push focus long term. But economy as a whole, from what we see, local spending is really, really bad right now. And I think macroeconomic factors are playing an effect. And what I see is like interest rates are spiking. There's less investments that are happening, less projects from both government projects because of budget cuts. Because the government formed after the budget cycle. So the government was not fast enough to be able to get budget approval. So a lot of the big infrastructure projects were actually delayed or was not approved funding. So they're actually going to start getting funding only in April this year. So a lot of these delays have trickled down to companies getting not doing so well performing, especially the government-related companies were not performing so well. So the only sector that is booming right now is tourism sector. So hotels, hospitality industry is actually doing quite well. But if you ask me as a whole, if you're not targeting tourist market right now, the business market is very, very bad. And I see that until at least middle of this year because Thailand didn't face an inflation problem. So the interest rates spiking up in the whole world was because to control inflation, especially in the US and Europe. But Thailand, like if you talk about food prices, talk about like transport, talk about a car, talking about buying a refrigerator, TV, prices has been more or less the same in the last 5 years, maybe 10% spike. But in the US and Europe, it's been spiking up a lot. And that's where I heard like tissues were running out and a lot of the things were like refrigerator, you have to order a year in advance. So like stuff like because of semiconductors running out and all these kind of things. So I think the whole supply chain shock in the US has caused the price to gone up and the interest rate to gone up. In Thailand, the interest rate has gone up because of currency exchange control. Because if Thailand didn't increase the interest rate, then all the money will flow out and people will go and do savings in the US, in the UK or in Western market where there's higher interest rates, right? And then it would basically become a problem for the currency. So because of controlling the currency, the economy is shit right now. And that's how I take it. It may be other factors, like travels are becoming more expensive and people still value travel. So they're spending less on other things. Job market is not so good. There's a lot of layoffs happening. So that is also another factor. Yeah, but overall, I see the next 6 months as still being bad.
Yeah, I mean, just a few points that you mentioned there. I mean, how it compares as well to the region. I think when you look at things like the demographics of Thailand being, you know, the average age is, I think, on par with like Southern Europe, for example. So I think it's like about 40, whereas yep. In Cambodia, we're in Philippines, Indonesia, it's sort of going through their kind of peak positive demographics being like late 20s. Yeah. We're about 27 here, the average age.
Yeah.
But I guess for Thailand, the main way to alleviate that is the tourist arrivals, right? And I think it's top five in the world, 30 yeah. million tourists yeah. or so a yeah. year. Mm. But still, you're seeing GDP growth of only about 2-3%, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, it seems like a bit of a mixed bag whether you're in the in something that really plays to the tourism market versus more so the local economy and dealing more with the as you say, local spending power.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you don't, the tourism is growing by all means, but the agriculture, the local spending, the whole GDP, I think if you take out tourism, it's actually going down.
Okay, and but maybe on like to shift to like I guess more of the on the tech side of things and startups, do you still see like a big focus for technology for startups to be registered in Thailand and then looking to go regional? Or do you think most of the startups that you're seeing in Thailand today are focused fully on the local market, or there's more appetite to take an idea regional?
I mean, this is again my perspective. I'm like third generation living in Thailand. Like my family's moved here from India, Pakistan during the partition. But I feel like Thailand is very comfortable life. It's never been ruled. It's never been colonized. So the comfort of being in there's a word in Thailand, we call it sabai sabai. So sabai sabai means chill, chill, right? So it's like, just take it easy. Like you earn in the morning, you use it up in the evening. And tomorrow there's always money available. So the culture here is like not scared. Like people are not scared to lose their job. People are not take like interviews so seriously. People just like feel like there's a lot of opportunities available, which is a good thing. But it also doesn't make you hungry. It doesn't make you strive. It doesn't make you push for growth, right? So till today, I've seen maybe like two or three startups that have gone outside of Thailand that I started in Thailand. And those ones are also mostly formed by non-Thais. And mostly those are B2B startups. So till today, I don't think there is a B2C startup that has gone outside of Thailand. And I really want to be hopefully the first, not just because of being the first. I want to show that it is possible at that time. But it's just that, I guess it's the comfort. And it's not only from the startup founders, it's even from the VCs. They're like, why go outside? Why don't just cover more and more in Thailand? You know, they're like, they don't want to take the risk. They're not risk takers at the end of the day. They're, like I said, sabai sabai culture. So that's what I see as a weakness of Thailand. And because of government restrictions, like hiring international, like if you're not board of investment registered company, you can't hire, like you have to have like a ratio of 4 Thais to 1 foreigner. So, and if you don't have a high registered capital, you can't hire many foreigners. So the local talent is not good enough here. And so for me, there's a lot of things that needs to be adjusted to be flexible, to be able to compete in the global market. Even like 51%, like has to be local ownership, 49% foreign ownership allowed. So these are all restrictions to make the startup industry really successful and to make the Thai founders really, because if you don't get, it's almost like a protected bubble, right? No international startup can come full form as easily to compete with you. But then you can't go out because you don't feel the pressure and you're happy in your bubble, right? And because Thailand is not a big enough market in terms of population, in terms of GDP, that makes investor feel like you can be a local enough player. That's why a lot of international VCs don't come into Thailand. And that's the main issue, that it's almost like a vicious cycle that keeps Thailand small the way it is.
Wow. Yeah, that's really interesting to maybe lean into a little bit. I guess in terms of Hungry Hub's expansion plans, what do you have on your sights for the next year or two?
Yeah, so for us this year, like I mentioned, if you don't hit the tourism market, you're going to fall flat, right? So for us this year, in the past, we've been like 95% local market. Now we are about 85% local market. By end of the year, I'm hoping for 50-50. And why that? Because tourists spend more. They're here for a short time, but they're looking for the best stuff. and they eat out almost every meal while they're here. Whereas the local maybe eat out once a month or once a week, stuff like that. And they don't spend like the highest compared to the tourists. So what I mean is there might still be higher local volume, but the GMV share might be split 50-50 between the tourists and locals at the end of the year. And how we're doing that is right now we are not just selling directly through our channels. We're actually doing integrations with third parties. So we are selling. So what we have done as Hungry Hub is we've basically productized the restaurant industry into like almost like an e-commerce product. Previously, if you realize, the restaurant industry was not able to sell as an e-commerce product. Only food delivery was able to do it. But now we are taking the dine-in category and we are making that into like a product. What? How? Like party pack, all you can eat, experience and stuff like that, like omakase, Michelin course. They're all price per person or price per two people or sharing, right? So with that, we are making that dining experience into like a, we have a price tag. It becomes like almost like a spa. It becomes like an experience. So we are selling it on activity platforms like KKday, Klook, Traveloka, Trip.com, like Get Your Guide and all these kind of like players. We're basically doing APIs. And then the restaurant uses Hungry Hub, but the Hungry Hub is now not just selling it to locals, but distributing it on multiple third-party platforms. Similar to how Agoda shares their room allotments with Ctrip or Booking.com, we are basically doing that, sharing and then do revenue share with these parties. So that's how we're getting to the tourists for distribution. But we're also doing a lot of self-service, like building the tools so that the restaurant can basically self-onboard, self-manage. Our strength is in menu, what you call proposal, like how to price, how to propose a good menu. We're trying to get into AI, basically using a lot of the data we have already built, past proposals, put it into a learning engine. And then, yeah, letting like restaurants upload their a la carte menu. And then based on certain criteria that they put in internally by some input and external and our own internal data, come up, churn out like a proposal instantly. So that's like an internal like local, like a Hungry Hub brain that we can kind of do as well. So there are a few things for us is we want to scale outside of Thailand by next year. So why are we getting into these tourist players is that once we go outside of Thailand, we can't depend on getting new supply, new demand. So if we already have these demands and we go to Singapore, we go to like Korea, or we go to Vietnam, Cambodia, and we say that we already have 10 tourist platforms that exist in your country, and we're just building the supply. So it's easy to get the supply when you have the demand, but it's hard to build the chicken and egg side again in the next markets. Because right now I only have restaurants in Thailand and customers in Thailand. If I go to Singapore and I have to build the restaurant in Singapore and customers in Singapore, it's almost like starting from zero. But if I have Trip.com, Klook, KKday, all these customers that are from regionally or globally, then I don't have to build that again. So for me, I want to grow profitably, organically, and get back the growth lever. Like last year, we grew maybe 10% year on year, but last 6 months, we were profitable. But this year, I want to get back to 50% growth while being profitable.
That all those plans sound like is very exciting. When you think about the Hungry Hub brain, I like the that idea, especially around the concept of leveraging AI to be able to make some of those parts of the business a little bit more streamlined and easier.
Yeah.
As we transfer into our last section of the podcast, talking a little bit more about yourself and your interpersonal side, I think one of the things that always comes up in our conversations is how does a founder and CEO maintain a healthy work-life balance? Is there specific practices that you have, whether it's, you know, yoga or meditation, or is it something else that you like to do?
Yeah. So last 5 years not been easy, but yeah, I mean, I've actually, because before I started doing my own startup, I was working in the corporate world, like I mentioned. And the corporate world, I was working 12 hours to 15 hours a day. So I've gone through that life once. And I think in the younger days, But when I started this company, I made it a point where I'm going to make it like more like a healthy long-term business. It's not going to be like 3 years where I burn myself out and I'm done with it, right? So there are days that I work till late, but most of the days I come into office at like 10, 10:30 and I leave by 7, 7:30. So I do like a normal 8, 9 hour day. My lunch is okay. I don't really, if it's not a lunch meeting, then I have it on my desk or very rare. I really walk out to step out for lunch, like just casually. But it's always like lunch as an opportunity to network, mingle, or work lunch with the team. So that's my thing that I stretch a little bit. But and then because I'm in the F&B business, there are days that I have dinner meetings or there are events in the startup scene that I have to take part in. So I try to limit those to once a week. If there is multiple really important, then I exceptionally, but maybe like 4 to 5 times a month, I go out in the evening. Otherwise, I'm home with my family, wife. I have 2 kids, 5 and 3. And they're young. They are they sleep early. They go to bed early. So I try to make it home before they go to bed because they're in school now. So, and for me, other than outside of work, what do? I play soccer once a week. That's my time out with my friends and 2 hours of soccer a week. And then actually Harprem, I play with him as well. And then I try to run, just getting started back. I used to, for me, running in the morning, it gives me a chance to like just freshen up before the day. So I try to do that once or twice a week, 30 minutes like outside at 7 a.m. Next to my house. And otherwise I think Friday night I usually crash. People go out partying. I'm like, I don't think I'm tired because of long hours, but it's a lot of things that goes on in the mind. And I try to shut off at home. I try not to use my computer at home. At max, it's just my phone. And I try to, when I'm with the kids, I try to keep the phone away. I think overall my wife keeps me in check. She's very, very helpful in that journey. She's very pro-family. And because she also doesn't work full-time. She's like a full-time. She works part-time, but she's more of a full-time mom. When the kid goes to school, she goes to teach a little bit. Hopefully, she'll go back to full-time becoming a teacher this year because both of my kids are in school now. So, I think my wife is the only person that keeps me in my balance. She always, if I'm working late, she'll call me and be like, are you done? Are you done? So I hope she doesn't listen to this podcast.
Sorry, we'll send her a direct link.
But she's the one that basically makes me not go crazy because I'm obsessed with work. And if she goes on a holiday or she goes to stay in a parent's house, and I'm home alone with no kids, I'll be up on my computer until like midnight because I still have a lot of pending things to do. And I like to clear things off, but it's never going to be clear. It's always going to pile up.
It's always going to be a little bit more and a little bit more, no matter what.
There's always things to do. You know, it's your startup company. You've built it 10 years. Yeah, there's a lot of opportunities to grow, but you just have to deal with the hours of the day that you have.
Yeah, that's an important piece of it, is finding that balance and also focusing on being present, like you said, with your family when you put the computer away and you're with the kids and in that sense. So that's really, really, really great. What are some of the podcasts that you're listening to today?
When I go for my run, I do that. So it's once, twice a week. There's some local ones called Secret Sauce. So that like up there, they interview some business people here and there. There's one in India that is run by this startup founder called Nikhil Kamat. So he does a very interesting type of podcast. He does a round table for people like who are the experts in that industry all around India to come and talk about a topic. So like they had like restaurant owners coming to talk about the whole. So the podcast is called WTF is going on in that industry. So it's like WTF is going on in that VC industry. WTF is going on in the restaurant industry. So he brings up like different problems, different topics. So it's very interesting. And the podcast runs for like 3.5 hours. So I don't finish it in one go, but it's like a dinner table conversation that they have once a month. And it's these guys, they, because when it's long, it goes into very detail. And the guy is the interviewer is a founder. So he already has a lot of knowledge, and he basically very quickly takes out the juice and goes straight to the meat. So I think there's a lot of insights that I've gotten. Like, I think a lot of podcasts, when it's like 45 minutes, 1 hour, like you get to the meat maybe after like 20 minutes or 30 minutes, right? But when you do it for 3 hours, that it becomes like 2 hours or 3 hours of meat. So you get a lot out of that. So that's how I see it a little bit different in that podcast.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, just getting straight into the point, and then, you know, those kind of discussions always evolve into bigger conversations that you didn't think that you were going to be jumping in on. So, we'll actually have to try it. We'll have to listen to an episode or two on that. So it sounds very interesting. Yeah, would love that. What does success mean to you?
I think balance is number one. I think success without balance is not a success. So I would put that word very high up. And second is, I think success for me is more about the team. Like, it's not a one-man show. Like, I feel like if the team feels, and if the team is part of the success, I feel it's more successful. And last for me is, if you ask about Hungry Hub today, my next milestone of success is to expand beyond Thailand and to make this business and not a Thailand-only business. Yeah, that's really why I'm still have that passion waking up and still have that fire in me. Because I think today in Thailand, we are doing well already. A lot of people call us successful in Thailand, but I wouldn't say we're there 100% yet. Well, we're doing well. But I think for me, it's like I'm trying to prepare ourselves so that I go into a next market very strong.
Yeah, absolutely. And our traditional closing question that we like to ask each of our guests is, what is the most important piece of advice that you've ever been given?
Actually, when I was at the point of shutting down the business, I was asked, so I was in the US for a conference, and one of the mentor over there, they were assigned like one mentor per table and stuff. So he asked me, what's your brand promise? Like, what does Hungry Hub stand for your consumers or your restaurants, right? And what do you want it to stand for? And are people willing to pay for that brand promise? So that really like kicked in, like, because when I was thinking about the reservation system, there was no real one really wanting to pay for that service, or there was real need in that service. So for me, I realized that I need to pivot into something that was solving a problem that people were willing to pay for, and there was real need, right? So when we looked at the second model, brand promise was very simple. We were going to help restaurants increase more revenue sustainably. And we basically, for the consumers, were just to like basically have these exclusive deals that let them control the budget. Even though we never voiced out that we were the platform for controlling budget, a lot of people were able to tell us that when I think of Hungry Hub, I think of not fearing to try that restaurant, and I know that this is how much I'm going to pay. But we never promoted that as a brand value at all, because how can you say control budget is sexy? It's not a sexy word. We got to say like we have deals and all these kind of things. But our deals revolve around the fundamental, the promise that we wanted to deliver. And yeah, like if you think about Uber, like the brand promise is security, safety, like underlying factor, transparency. Everyone would say the same word. I think if you're not able to get your brand promise straight and aligned, that all your consumers are saying the same thing, why they use your service in three simple words that are 90% aligned, then I think you've not gotten there yet. And that's the advice that was given. And that's how I looked at pivoting my business. And I think it's a long way to go. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, long way to go, but it sounds like the journey so far has been great. There's been tremendous success so far. a lot of happy customers. And for us, we are really appreciative of you coming on to Rising Giants with us today, Sursit. And we are really looking forward to trying the product next time we're in Thailand. I want to look through the catalog just to pick the restaurant that I want to try now. So any suggestions after the episode, I will be more than happy to take. So just want to thank you again for your time and really appreciate it.
For having me here. And if you're in town next, we'll catch up for a meal.
Yes. Thanks. Yeah. We look forward to that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers.